It is currently 7:14. Aaron Ashberg joins us now, assistant professor of urban peri-urban entomology at LSU, to talk about another bug that's kind of made its way here that's not a lot of fun, stinging Asian needle ants. How you doing, Professor?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. Everybody's got a story, and I want to hear yours. Tell me how, as a kid, were you, like, fascinated with insects, and that's what led you to where you are? I'm just curious about this.
That's exactly right. I was one of those bug kids running around collecting insects of all kinds. And not only that, I did reptiles and amphibians and birds, dinosaurs, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, Lord, thank goodness you weren't my kid. Thank goodness. Your parents let you have all that in the house or not?
What was that?
Your parents let you have all that in the house?
Well, not all of it, but they would indulge me from time to time.
I would have to draw the line at snakes. Let's talk about these. What is it, a stinging Asian needle ant? How big are these? Where'd they come from? How much of a threat are they?
Yeah, so the Asian needle ant is it's a medium-sized ant. I would say probably about the large size of the fire ants. This would probably be equivalent to what the Asian needle ant looks like. Now, remember, those fire ants, they have multiple sizes that they can be in. This ant is from Asia, China, Japan, that area. It typically lives in forested areas, and that is also where we found it, here in Louisiana. Now, this ant has a similar impact on the environment as our other invasive ant species. It has the potential to impact native fauna through outcompeting other native ants. And our native ants, they help support our native ecosystem. The other side effect or potential danger of this ant, I would say, is, of course, these medical aspects that we're seeing and hearing about with this ant. Now, as you already alluded to, it is capable of stinging. Mm-hmm. Now, it is not an aggressive ant. It's not like a fire ant. It won't come after you. However, there is that potential, if you are hypersensitive, to be stung and for that ant to induce anaphylaxis if you are sensitive. And so there is that risk associated with this ant.
So where did they come from again? How did they get here?
Yeah, so they came from China or Japan. They are an Asian native ant. I don't particularly know how they got here. We did start to find them, I believe, in the 1930s in Georgia. So they have been here for some time. Now, within Louisiana, we had not had any reports of the ants. And so we actually started to get some inquiries. People were asking if it was here. And so actually we looked on a citizen scientist website called iNaturalist. Mm-hmm. We actually had two reports by some citizen scientists, Sean Golden and Mike Tybin. They were actually really critical in us finding this ant in the state. Essentially, we went and ground-truthed their sightings. We collected the ant. We brought it back to the lab and identified it and confirmed that it was, in fact, the Asian needle ant.
Would we recognize these? Do they build an ant hill bigger than any other? Or, I mean, how would we know if we see them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is a different ant in that sense. It does not create mounds in the traditional sense. They typically live in close association with termites. They are where
well,
I found them
with that. You see that, Aaron? It's all about who you hang out with. That tells you everything you need to know, don't you think?
That's right.
Right there. Okay.
And of course. So, you know, with the termites, you know, hopefully they will consume some Formosan subterranean termites for us. However, you know, they live in that wet wood. That's what they're feeding upon, as well as other insects. So you would typically encounter them if you're digging in the soil or you're working with wet wood. They're kind of more on the outskirts of environments. However, that doesn't necessarily mean that they can't invade our territory and potentially cause health effects if they sting us.
Got to tell you, Aaron, you got everybody's attention when you said eat Formosan termites, do they?
Well, they are a termite specialist. They do prefer to eat termites. I don't know what the impact will be on our Formosan subterranean termites. I'm sure they're here to stay, but if they can reduce some of those numbers, I'm sure everybody would be happy.
See, I know that one thing that I can remember when I first learned about this in grammar school about ecosystems, maybe seventh grade, and how delicate they are and how just a little bit of this can mess up a lot of that. But, man, if these things could eat termites, I guess that would be good, but then you might have to find something to eat the stinging Asian needle ant?
That's correct, and at this time, we don't have any predators for the Asian needle ant. Maybe other invasive ants might suppress their populations. That could be why we hadn't found them in Louisiana until recently. But, you know, given that potential, I don't think they would completely eliminate termites. However, like I said, there could be some exclusion effects where the ants come in, the Asian needle ants come in and take over an environment. Maybe there would be less termites in that area, maybe less of our other invasive ants as well if they're able to establish a foothold. Now, they don't build as big of colonies mm-hmm. as, say, fire ants, so that would be a disadvantage to them compared to some of our other invasive ants that we have.
I want to talk about ants some more when we come back. I know you mentioned a medium ant. My aunt Maureen was a medium ant. My aunt Florence was just a big, giant ant. 720 traffic now, WWO. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with Aaron Ashbrook, our friend, assistant professor of urban, peri-urban entomology at LSU, talking about the invasive stinging Asian needle ant that has been spotted in the state. And you can always download the Odyssey app if you want to go back and listen to anything we had to say. Let me get this in here real quick if I can, Aaron. We believe in the power of being everywhere. Listen to WWL anytime, anywhere. You get the WWL shows you love. Dave Cohen, me, Newell, Scoot, Sports Talk, and all the local content you crave on the Odyssey, iHeart, and TuneIn apps. You can go back and listen. So tell me, where did these things come from, these ants? Do we know where they came from? And while we're at it, tell me about the Formosan termites, because I guess they came ultimately from Formosa, but how did they get here?
Yeah, so they're actually probably from similar regions of Asia. So the Asian needle ant, it's been found in China, it's been found in Japan. Of course, I do believe it was in the Taiwan region, which, of course, that's where the Formosan subterranean termite came from as well. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll guess that we acquired the Asian needle ants through trade. That is how we get most of our invasive species. Now, the Formosan subterranean termite, we actually got that invasive termite after World War II. It was pretty well documented that when some of the ships came back from the Pacific, those life rafts were infested with the termites. Okay. And so those wooden rescue boats had them inside already. And once we got those boats off onto the mainland, they were able to quickly establish and spread from there.
So once an invasive species gets here, and again, I'm getting all excited about maybe these Asian ants would eat termites, but we don't know that yet, right?
Well, I know for sure that they do eat termites. However, I guess what I would say is we don't know what the impact would be on our termite populations in the region. However, I would not be too hopeful about it. I don't think they will impact their populations as much as we would hope.
So once an invasive species does get here, is it here to stay? And that's going to lead me into the next question. And I don't know if you talk about this or not, but these screw worms that we're just talking to Mike Strain about, that, you know, now they're starting to affect Mexican beef and so forth and jump in containment. And Mike said he was at about a 6 on a scale of worry between 1 and 10. Talk about, if you will, once an invasive species gets here, how hard is it to get rid of it? And I guess you look at the termites and the answer would be not easy, right?
Yes, that is correct. So there are several different factors that are involved in the establishment and the invasion of an invasive species. Kind of what you're alluding to, just because that organism gets here doesn't necessarily mean it will establish. You know, it has to have a viable food, an environment that is suitable for it. Typically with our invasive species, they escape a predator or an organism that typically preys upon it. So if there isn't another organism that will consume that invasive species in the area, that will also help it establish in an area. And, of course, it has to be able to reproduce and spread to new locations. And that's ultimately what we would say is an established invasive species. If we're finding new colonies or new populations in different locations than the initial invasion point.
So when it comes to the screwworm, and I don't know if you're prepared to talk about this, and I didn't invite you on to talk about this, how concerned are you about this thing?
Well, it has been pretty impactful for the cattle industry in the past. It does do extensive damage to the cow as well as to the hide, the leather. We had some major programs in the U.S. historically to make sure that we eliminated it from our country, you know, essentially to keep it out because of its impacts. And so, you know, if Mike Strain is saying that he is concerned about it, I would also be concerned about it as well. He probably has some more information about the potential spillover that is occurring than I do. Mm-hmm. However, yes, I would definitely be concerned about it and its potential impacts that it could
only
have.
Only something in it. Aaron, do you ever talk with the Department of Defense, or is that part of any like, because it would seem like one way a country could attack another is to put an invasive species of insects that could cause them a whole lot of problems. Is that part of some of what you do or not?
I don't necessarily do that type of work. There has been, of course, like you alluded to, people have looked at in the past, you know, using insects as biological war agents. Mm-hmm. The DOD is very supportive of pest management and, you know, mosquitoes, ticks, bed bugs, other blood-feeding organisms. They do support research to manage those organisms so that we can better protect military members across the, you know, whether they're overseas or in the U.S., as well as citizens. So they do like applicable research that affects these disease-vectoring organisms and help improve the operations of military individuals as well.
Thank you, Aaron. I appreciate your time, as always. Aaron Ashbrook, Assistant Professor of Urban Peri-Urban Entomology at LSU. If I were in charge, I would release butterflies just to spread happiness and joy, because that's the way I am. Time now, WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Phil Napoli, professor of public policy at Duke, author of Social Media in the Public Interest, Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age. How you doing, Phil?
I'm doing good, thanks.
So I heard about Linda Yaccarino, is that how you say it, stepping down after leading X, and I thought about, immediately my thought went, was, would I want to work for Elon Musk? And the answer was, no, absolutely not. But with that being said, tell me what's going on with, and you have to go slow here, because I understand about half of what's going on here, other than the fact that, you know, Holocaust denial and proliferation of Nazi stuff is not good, that I understand, but tell me what's going on with this Grok and Elon Musk, and I don't get all of this. Take us through it, please.
Sure. So X has an AI chatbot that Elon Musk's AI company has created, and its name is Grok. Mm-hmm. And it posts on X, and you can, you know, engage with it on X. And apparently a week or so back, Elon Musk felt that Grok was too woke, that some of its responses to queries and such reflected the left-leaning biases of the mainstream media, so he promised to fix it. And apparently that fix has meant that Grok is a big fan of Hitler and the Holocaust, and called itself Mecha Hitler in one post, but now, of course, Grok has been temporarily shut down to be retooled again. So, in short, the chatbot is spewing a lot of anti-Semitic stuff in the wake of it being retooled to be less woke.
So I just called it up on Twitter, and it says, on X, whatever it is, Grok says, we are aware of recent posts made by Grok and are actively working to remove the inappropriate posts. Since being made aware of the content, XAI, XA1, who is that? Who's XAI? Oh, artificial intelligence. XAI, I get it. Okay. Has taken action to ban hate speech before Grok posts on X. XAI is training only truth-seeking. And thanks to the millions of users on X, we are able to quickly identify and update the model where training could be improved. So what the hell does that mean? Who is Grok saying we are aware? Who is the we behind Grok?
It's XAI, this is their,
Wait, is that people?
I feel
like I'm talking about Soylent Green.
This is an autonomous, AI chatbot. So it is given, it can be, retooled where it can, the instructions that guide it can be changed. And so whatever the instructions were a week or so back to instruct it to try to be less politically correct, this is the outcome. So it's sort of, back to the drawing board, back to the lab with Grok. And presumably it will reappear, and presumably it will behave a bit differently than it has over the past week or so.
All right, so let me phrase it a different way. Why would I want to get involved with Grok? What would I use it for?
You have asked the million-dollar question. You have the same question I have. What is the point? Why do
that's,
any of
that's
us
it.
To engage?
Phil, that, you nailed it. What is the point of all? That's what I'm trying to get at. What is the point?
I think the point is to try to, if, again, I'm speculating here because I think there is no point, personally, to try to showcase, what AI can do. And this is the thing is, within the high profile examples of AI are in these sort of generative AI spaces where people can chat and engage with AI bots. And feel like they are engaging with a human being. And somehow we're supposed to be impressed by this. And perhaps this is, something that will spur further investment. But no, I think, there are lots of valuable things AI could do. Perhaps it could have done a better job of predicting flooding patterns, for example. Mm-hmm. But this sort of thing, I see no point.
I saw a thing on TV. We got to take a break here. We can pick it up. We come back. Some network had a story about a guy that was opting for a relationship with AI or a chatbot rather than a real person because apparently was telling him what he wanted to hear. And again, my question is, what is the point in this? I don't understand. Why would you not just talk into a mirror and tell yourself what you want to hear? Maybe I'm looking at it differently. We'll talk about how AI chatbots work in general. Phil Napoli is our guest, professor of public policy at Duke, author of Social Media in the Public Interest, Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age. And of course, what is concerning about this is that if people go to a chatbot for information and they get misinformation, well, then they think it's genuine and then they pass it along. And Lord knows we've had enough of that already. 7:50 traffic now, WWL. 7:56, 4 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Phil Napoli, professor of public policy at Duke, author of Social Media in the Public Interest, Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age, rather. Elon Musk's Grok AI started having some problems praising Hitler. Microsoft tried to do this back in 2016, I think it was. They launched a Tay artificial intelligence chatbot, and people apparently gamed it into praising Hitler. And again, it goes to what's the point in this, Phil, that you said earlier. I don't understand. So people, and then I saw a thing on television, a network story about a guy that opted for chatbot as opposed to a human relationship. This is just a computer talking back to you based on what people program it to say, reacting to what it is that you put into it?
Yeah, and that's the important thing to remember, the nuts and bolts of how these work. They are, there's this massive amount of data. So you figure something like Grok is at the very minimum loaded with every post on Twitter and X in its history. Mm-hmm. And all it's doing is trying to predict. The way these AI systems work is to predict what word should come next. Mm-hmm. So any notion that there's, profound thought happening there that would be, say, valuable to you as you're looking for a friend or seeking relationship advice. Some of these things are
Yeah, let me jump in for a second, because if I'm going to say chatbot, Philbot, okay, what's the best way for me to feel better about myself? I mean, that's foolishness, right? Tell me about
this. If the next question is, what is the chatbot drawing upon to answer your question? And as we know, that's one of the things that these AI companies have been doing has been, just sucking up any kind of content, any kind of data, everything they can get their hands on that becomes the raw material that informs the outputs of the chatbot. You know, it's indiscriminate. We don't know oftentimes what they do and don't have access to. Why we should feel confident in responses generated based on, you know, mathematical equations about what word to choose next from this vast, you know, quantity of text is a bit mind-boggling to me. That
so it's just matching this with that, right? It's like in the old days when you were a kid, they'd give you match this with that on a test. That's what this is doing, but at like 1,000 miles an hour. Accurate?
Right. It's like, all right, what is the most likely word that should follow this word based on the trove of data we have in our database? So this is the most likely word that comes next. So, you know, unfortunately, what this tells us about Grok is that there's been a lot of anti-Semitism on Twitter and X over the years, which we already know is the case. So no one should be surprised at all that this is the way Grok is behaving. It's behaving the way a lot of users on the platform have behaved for years and years.
20 seconds. I want to look something up. Where should I go?
You want to look something up?
Yeah.
It's frustrating to me. Even good old-fashioned Google now shoves AI responses down your throat, whether you ask for it or not. So I don't even know. I'm not satisfied with any of my options right now. I need to do some more digging on that.
I don't think my Uncle George has his Encyclopedia Britannicas anymore, and even if he did, they'd be outdated by now. Thank you, Phil. Appreciate it. We'll talk to Arthur Hardy about Mardi Gras when we come back. WWL.